You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is back open for live shows, classes, and customized corporate workshops and events. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. For more information, go to secondcity.com. The Second City is excited to work with Amazon as part of their new and exciting app called AMP. AMP is a home where anyone can create live radio-style shows alongside some of the biggest names in the entertainment industry, including ours. Join the Second City live every Thursday at 5 p.m. Central Time for our show, Second City Public Radio. SCPR is an interactive weekly lampoon of all things public radio. Each week, our host and an ever-expanding panel of Second City characters open up the lines to listeners from around the U.S. to ask questions and offer us opinions on a slew of wide-reaching subjects. Download the app and don't forget to tune in AMP Thursdays at 5 p.m. Central Time.
All right. I loved this book. I'm talking to Dan Willingham, Daniel T. Willingham, who's a psychologist at the University of Virginia, where he's a professor in the Department of Psychology. His research focuses on the application of findings from cognitive psychology and neuroscience to K-12 education. So his latest book is called Outsmart Your Brain, Why Learning is Hard and How You Can Make It Easy. I highly recommend this book for everyone. It is certainly great for your high schoolers and your college students and PhD students. But, you know, we're all lifelong learners, or we should be. And even if we aren't, this book tells you how you learn and how you don't. It is radical in that I've just never seen this laid out quite like this. Already gave it to my wife. She's already read it. Definitely, it is a great podcast. He's a great guest. Enjoy the pod.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Daniel T. Willingham, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
I love this book so much. And there's so much potential ground to cover, but I want to start with a story you tell in the conclusion of the book. It's the fall of your third year as a professor at the University of Virginia, and two senior professors are arguing over the written account you provided about your achievements in research and teaching to that point. What was this argument about?
Yeah, so the purpose of this meeting is sort of a check-in. As most of your listeners will know, it's very high. Tenure is a very high-stakes decision because it's kind of a job for life or you're fired. They do. There aren't that many professions where it's that stark. And so they try to help you a little bit along the way and let you know how things are going. So after you've completed 2 years, you submit a packet of your things, and then a couple of senior professors look it over, and then they're supposed to give you advice. And these two senior professors, you know, they did, as I say in the book, they did this very professory thing. They got interested in their own conversation and debate about an issue that wasn't really that directly related to me. They were, because one of them said something like, it seems like you don't really think that research is fun. Like, you're so grim when you're describing everything you're doing. Like, don't you think research should be fun? And the other person cut in and says, who says research should be fun? Like, it's hard work. And then they were just off to the races talking about whether a good researcher has fun. And I'm just sort of sitting there twiddling my thumbs. And then eventually they remembered I was in the room, and the meeting kind of ended at that point. They were like, no, it looks like you're doing fine. And it was kind of game over.
Now, to be clear, you do fall in the fun camp, don't you?
I do. Yeah. I mean, I admittedly, like, I'm sure I was being not only grim in the written documentation, but at the meeting, because, you know, I was nervous. I was worried about, you know, how things were going. But no, I mean, I think there aren't that many people who are in academia who aren't in it for anything other than passion. Like, no, you know, you're gravely misinformed if you think, oh, I'm in this for the money. Like, you're not going to make a lot of money. No. And so, yeah, you better enjoy it.
Now, my wife just got tenure, and she is a professor of comedy. She runs the first ever BA in comedy writing and performance at Columbia College here in Chicago. And she had to spend most of that period proving to people that she was serious. Right? It was like, right. Wait a second.
And that her field was legit, right? Well, big congratulations to her. That's great.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a huge thing. But it's funny, too, because the comedy conferences that she goes to are not funny. It's mostly philosophers, a very right. not funny lot, highly men, that sort of thing. But this weaves into your book, and I think of, I would call this book radical in the sense that you are going like to the beginning to talk about, this is the thing. I posted a quote, I forget which one, on LinkedIn, but I was like, if I had had this book at the beginning of high school, let's just say that, I think it would have made a huge difference. I think I was able to adopt a lot of what you talk about here in college through having incredible mentors and other people who kind of mm-hmm. ripped me out and allowed me to kind of do my thing. But I want to get an idea of like, what struck you that, no, I got to write this book, because this is like the ABCs of how we learn in a way that I've just never right. seen before.
Right. I'll tell you why. And I tell this story in the book, I think. What struck me is the extent to which in American schooling, students progressively become more and more responsible for their own learning, but we never teach them how to meet that responsibility. Mm. So the way I frame it is that, you know, you think about a preschooler, you don't have any expectations that they can bring anything to the table in terms of making sure that they learn something. You know, I joke in the book, like you never have a parent like berating their preschooler. Like your teacher says, like, you're not even trying to learn the alphabet. Right, like, what's right. up with that? Right. Mm-hmm. Whereas by the time they're in grade 12, like parents absolutely will do that. Right. Yeah. With a high school senior. And there's a whole raft of things you're expected to be able to do. That you're never taught to do. Things like how to learn from a lecture, how to take notes, how to study for a test, deal with procrastination, deal with anxiety, plan your time, all of these things. And we know that students aren't taught because we have surveys of college students. We ask them, how do you plan your time? And like, who taught you to do it that way? And by far the most common answer is, well, no one really taught me. I just kind of, you know, figured it out, or I watched YouTube videos, or my friends do it that way, that kind of thing.
And no one taught you, right? That wasn't...
No, absolutely. No one taught me. It was, I stumbled on some things, and a lot of them I didn't figure out until I was in graduate school.
Right.
And by that time I was already, you know, a year or two into studying human memory and human cognition. And so sort of putting it together, like, oh, well, you know, I learned these principles in class, like I should probably be using them when I'm trying to commit things to memory and study.
You write in the book, quote, wanting to learn has no direct impact on learning. I think that's an important statement because I think that's a presupposition that many people make.
And it's very natural. You know, the feeling that, and that I'll tell you, this was when I first went to graduate school, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do within the field of human cognition. And I was in a human memory course. And when a couple of experiments were described to me, that was so striking to me. That was what made me want to focus on human memory. But yeah, to be clear, the finding is that wanting to remember something has no impact. You can't directly control memory the way you can control, for example, your body. If you decide, yeah. I want my arm to move up, you can move your arm up. And that feeling of will, that feeling of control is very closely associated with actually moving your arm. But saying, you know, I want to remember this just doesn't do anything at all. What it can do is it can prompt you to, now there are some mental processes that you can control. And so what's mostly described in the book is tasks you can set for yourself that you can control that have a desirable byproduct, something you can't control. So a task you set for yourself that you can actually do, and then as a byproduct of doing that task, you're learning and remembering.
Interesting. We had Annie Murphy Paul on the podcast, who wrote a terrific book called The Extended Mind. And there's a section in there that really spoke to me, because I've worked in the theater my entire life. And she talks about the fact that many actors don't really remember their lines until they're blocking, because they're tying their movement to their lines. I'm like, oh, that's completely true. I've just seen that forever in traditional theater. And it's such a Western thing that we can think our way out of anything and not to pay attention to the body at all. But the body has a great influence on our ability to comprehend and memory and all those things, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Sometimes people in cognitive psychology, we have a tendency to do that, to forget the body. And so people will, you know, sort of warn you. It's like, we're not a brain on a stick. You know, we have a body, and the body actually matters. It's a little deceptive, actually, to call it a body, because we talk about muscle memory. Your muscles don't really have memory. Of course, what it is the part of your brain that controls movement, the part of your brain that knows where your body is, the part of your brain that appreciates space and movement. All of that is tied in with memory representations that we normally don't think of as participating in movement, spatial appreciation, and so on.
So Second City gets brought in to lots of businesses for training. And I think a lot of people, when we come in, assume that we're going to be doing like role playing. Well, they're a theatrical company, and we don't. When we're training people in improvisation, we are breaking it down. And one of the early things that we do, actually a lot of our work, is focused on listening. Mm-hmm. Because what we were, the founders of Second City in the late 50s, recognized that people don't particularly listen well, and that when you're making something out of nothing with someone, no script, you're doing the script together, you have to listen to every word that person says, maybe what's underneath that word. And when you talk about how to understand a lecture, one of the big things you say, and I love this because this is before all that else, is like, expect listening to require work. So I think that is the first hurdle, is that people don't expect it. They think it's just a rote aspect of what they're doing. Then there's other things to do underneath that.
Absolutely. And I mean, I see this in my students all the time. You know, they'll come into class. It seems passive. And there's certain types of listening that are kind of passive. You know, when you're just chatting with your friends, the cognitive demands are likely to be low. Your friends are going to be talking about things that you both know a lot about. And so the topics are probably familiar. And they're not likely, if they refer to something that was a while back in the conversation, they're likely to remind you of it. And they don't have a grand plan about what they're talking about, where the expectation is you're going to knit together a lot of complex ideas. So you're not dealing with new ideas that are complicated, which is exactly what you're dealing with if you're in a classroom situation. So that's where I think students frequently get confused. They're used to listening in casual situations, or in more formal situations like watching a movie or watching a performance. But a movie and a performance, while there's some complexity there, it's also been crafted by experts to be easy to understand. Frequently, it's going to be in a narrative format, and that's going to help you because you're familiar with that organization. And my students can really be forgiven if they kind of feel like they're attending a movie, because they're in there with 350 other people. I'm on a stage, for crying out loud. So you can see why they just sort of lay back. They're probably a little hungover, to tell the truth. And they just sort of lay back and expect that, you know, the meaning is going to kind of come to them. But yeah, that's not true at all. What I just said about what makes listening in some circumstances easy is usually absent in a lecture. Usually there is a complex message that you're expected to get out of this. It does require that you knit together some new complex ideas and put them into a whole that's larger than any individual idea. And furthermore, it's not going to be in a familiar format. It's not going to be in a story structure, but it is going to be structured. And you are expected, if you're a good listener, to actually figure out what that structure is.
You also talk in the book about a reluctance to ask questions. And I'm curious about this because we've worked closely with Nick Epley, and his research is about people. A lot of this is self-disclosure. They asking a question might reveal that you don't know something. But the fact is actually that I imagine you feel this way. I do. It's like, ask me questions. I want to know what you might not. So I'm curious what your experience is in terms of people's reluctance to ask questions and how you get them to do that.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm in the book, I'm talking to students. So I'm trying to take the student's perspective, and I give a little bit of advice to people who would be, in the authority position, a teacher or, in an organization, the boss or something. So I'll take each of those in turns. From the student's perspective, I try and encourage students to recognize that you may feel a little sheepish, a little foolish asking a question, but you should keep in mind, like, no one else is really seeing it that way. The one time you're annoying when you ask a question, like, I hate it when people say, oh, there are no bad questions. Of course there are bad questions.
There are some bad questions.
Like, yeah, that's ridiculous to say that. That just makes people, off the bat, you're not being honest, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, let's just talk about what the bad questions are, and then you'll know and you won't ask them. So the bad questions are the show-off questions.
Yeah.
Where it's, you're sort of taking the platform to show off what you know rather than legitimately seeking clarification. Clarification questions, nobody ever minds, right? Because we've all been there. Like, even if I get it and you don't, you asking a clarification question is no problem, right? Mm-hmm. The other one that students are sheepish about is if, Kelly goes on for 10 minutes explaining something to me and I really don't get it. And like, I feel dumb saying, I just don't get it, because it feels like I'm asking you to, go through the whole 10 minutes again. And what I point out is, like, you can alleviate some of that by describing what you do understand.
Right.
So that sort of shows, like, look, I got part of it. I'm not a complete dummy. And then that, of course, helps you to know, more focus your explanation for me. But I think the most important thing that I want to communicate to students is, even if you don't like it, this is something you need to learn how to do. It's sort of like saying, like, I'm not a math person. That doesn't mean you're never going to do math. It means, like, I appreciate this is hard for you. And you may never be great at it, but you can definitely improve. And it's definitely a skill that you need to have. So that's all from the student perspective. From the teacher or boss perspective, the main thing I point out is, like, think about what the perspective is of the people who are supposed to be putting questions to you. And if you're not getting questions, this very unlikely means you are so brilliantly clear in everything you say that no one ever has questions. Instead, it means people are uncomfortable, right? And need to figure out why that is and how to fix it.
Or you could just go around thinking you're a genius.
Yeah, that's an option too.
That is an option too. While this book is written about, like, school and those situations, there is nothing in here that is not applicable to the human condition as you age, as you go through work, any pursuit, because we are, whether we want to be or not, lifelong learners, and we might learn stuff that we should have learned long ago. We might not learn things, but this is what happens when you're an adult. And I certainly know in my experience, people talk about imposter syndrome. It's like, it's a real thing. And just because someone is accomplished, does not mean that they are secure, that they've been able to say the right thing or offer the right thing or communicate the right thing. And so this idea that we don't live in monologues, we live in dialogues, is a lot of what this book is about, which is, like, I know we don't think about it like the way you just described the classroom.
Yeah.
Bad setup for dialogues.
Right.
The fact that we don't move more when we're learning, bad setup for learning. And unfortunately, we seem to be stuck with that until, there's some greater change. But while we're there, so the example I want to get into is this section on how to take lecture notes. And so look, you're in school, but then in work, you're going to need to take notes. And one of the first things you say in this chapter is, quote, taking good notes requires making wise compromises. Okay. Right? So let's, I think someone listening would be like, well, what do you mean? Why would you have to compromise taking notes?
You have to compromise because taking notes during a presentation is pretty literally an impossible task. Mm-hmm. It's, and you know, you feel it when you're doing it. You are in cognitive overload mode the whole time you're trying to do it. And just think about what, you know, what all the, so break down what cognitively what's happening. You're listening to content that is new to you. You're trying to decide, you're trying to unravel those ideas and then decide which are the most important. And so that you can record only the most important ones. Then you're trying to decide how to phrase them. Then you have to actually record them, either type them or handwrite them. You're shifting attention between your notes and the speaker and possibly visual aids. And all of this is happening not at a pace set by you. It's a pace set by the speaker, which is usually feels uncomfortably fast. So the big, the thing that most often happens is, you know, something's got to give. You're not going to be able to do everything. And depending on sort of who you are and what the presentation is, you make different choices. Most often what people do is they give up on a little bit on understanding. Mm-hmm. Students are especially prone to this, and they're trying to get down as much as they can. And that's because students are preparing for an examination and they're highly motivated. Because this is complicated, they know if I try and paraphrase, I may not get it exactly right. And so I'd rather write down exactly what you say and then memorize that, because that is unchallengeably right in some sense. They'll say, like, you know, you said this. And so that's what I put on the exam. But making wise choices when you're taking notes in during a presentation really means thinking about what am I hoping to get out of this? And there are times where you actually do need to get down all of the details as closely as you can. So for example, you know, in a work situation, there may be a new protocol that everybody is supposed to be following, and you've gotten some documentation on it, and you're attending a talk where they're sort of elaborating on that and explaining the protocol to you. And it's very important that you get these details right. And then there may be another time where you're at a meeting and everybody is brainstorming ideas for a new marketing campaign or something. You don't need to take extensive notes. There's going to be what you really need to do is be listening and try to be creative. And occasionally, you know, someone will say something that sparks something, you'll want to write it down. So those are sort of extreme versions where it's like, one case is like writing stuff down for your life. And in a way, like, yeah, you don't need to understand deeply. You just need to make sure you get the details, and the other being the opposite. And so you need to think about what am I doing here, and what are my goals, and what's an appropriate note-taking strategy? What can I give up on a little bit so I can make sure I get what I need?
So what you're talking about, and this to me, I can't believe was not taught to me, which is everything is about context.
Mm-hmm.
Including
that statement, right? Interpreting that statement is very contextual. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So I, but like understanding, like, oh, why are we in this room? And so what you're talking about too is, I think, is if it's a physics exam and there's a formula, I should know the formula. If it's English lit, we're talking about Huckleberry Finn, I might want to be listening for, you know, there might be a metaphor thing. There might be something like, what are we trying to get? And those are very different ways to approach the room.
Yes.
And what I've experienced, and I feel bad for people with this, is then they don't know the room they're in or why they're in the room that they're in. And no one has taken the time to explain that. And they've just assumed we all understand why we're in these rooms.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of that. I mean, this is, it's very hard to remember what it's like not to be an expert. And this is, you know, I think being a good writer is about 95% being able to anticipate your audience's response. When they read this, are they going to cry? Are they going to be confused? You know, whatever it is. And if you know how your audience is going to respond, you'll know whether or not you're having the effect you hope to have. Same thing is true when you're a speaker. Same thing is true when you're talking to an employee and you're trying to convey an idea, the urgency of something or whatever it is. Understanding how people are receiving information, how they're putting it together, is absolutely essential and very, very difficult.
The chapter on how to learn from labs, activities, and demonstrations hit me because this seems to talk about exactly how we go into organizations. We have them do exercises. We don't do a lot of prep before. We just give them this sort of point of focus, ask them, and then they're embodied. So their embodied learning is like, okay, what did you feel? What came up for you? And then we start making certain connections. And one of the things you say in the chapter is, quote, when the purpose is the activity itself, know the difference between experience and practice. And I'd love to you to break down the differences between experience and practice, because that I don't think that's necessarily intuitive either.
Yeah, I mean, it's intuitive once you start thinking about examples that there are things that we do repeatedly that we don't get better at. For me, you know, typing is one example. I learned how to type when I was about 16. I haven't measured my typing recently. I think I'm about as fast now as I was then.
Yeah, same.
I was a terrible parallel parker when I learned how to drive at 17. I'm about as good now as I was at 17.
And that has not improved.
Although, yeah, I mean, it was actually really nice, Kelly, because I was terrified going into it. Yeah. And then, like, I knew I was just going to fail that part of the exam. And so possibly for that reason, like, I just didn't give a damn. I just, like, swooped into the space. And that's the one time in my life by parallel. Yeah, I did. I was successful. Anyway, so what's the real difference between practice and experience? Experience is something you're doing either functionally, like driving a car or parallel parking or typing, where it's just like you're getting the task done, or it's performance that you're doing just for yourself or friends. So like another thing that I do with real mediocre level of talent is play guitar. Okay. And once again, I have not really improved very much, but I just play for my own pleasure. And so you sort of start to see what it's going to take for it to be practice. You need to actually be trying to get better. So you need to be focused. You need to be thinking about what is it I don't do well. You need to have strategies that you're trying something different compared to what you've been doing. And you need adequate feedback. Practice is a lot of work. And there are a lot of things we don't practice. A lot of things in our work life we don't practice and probably shouldn't. Exactly, because you need to be selective. You can't practice everything. And then, of course, when you put it that way, there are probably some things that we ought to be practicing a little more than we are.
Absolutely. So my friends in academia don't love Malcolm Gladwell, in part in this area where he talks about like the 1700 hours and sort of misappropriating Erickson's work, because the two things you talk about in this chapter that original study talked about that he didn't was mentorship and feedback. And deliberate practice, this idea of it's not just your desk by yourself. It's that idea. There's a little bit of wisdom of crowds in there. And then this, what deliberate practice means. And that means sort of a kind of intentionality that is again, nuanced.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You're right. I mean, you're right. A lot of academics don't like Malcolm Gladwell's work very well because they do think he is a little bit loose with some of this stuff. And Erickson's book Peak had about the most polite takedown of Gladwell I've ever seen. Anders Erickson was a very gentlemanly, sweet individual, and he did describe ways in which Gladwell's account of his work was inadequate, but he was. I could have never written anything that artful.
Oh, that one. Yeah. Okay. That's nice. you also, and I'm curious, in the section on how to take tests, you talk a lot about self-care in that section. And I'm curious in your years in academia, how that has evolved. The understanding of, again, I'm married to a college professor and Second City works with young people. So I'm experiencing a lot of young people who are coming in hurt in a way that they didn't appear. Past generations just didn't seem to have the same. And I understand it in terms of like, I've got a 25-year-old and COVID and lots of different things. But again, let me just stop it at evolution of the idea of self-care being important from you as a young professor to where you are now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's as you get more and more experience with students, you come to a greater and greater appreciation, first of all, the diversity of experience of students, and you learn how many students are facing challenges that you couldn't have guessed at. I had it quite easy as an undergraduate, and most of the people I knew had it pretty easy. I did know some students who were facing pretty significant challenges, but as a professor, I've gotten to know many more. I mean, I had a student who wasn't showing up very often for my class, and when he did, he wasn't very dialed in. And it wasn't until about mid-semester that I talked to him about this and learned that his parents had cut him off. Uh-huh. And he was at UVA only because he had ROTC as a scholarship. And he was tending bar at college, you know, nearby bars until 3 a.m. and then trying to catch a couple hours of sleep and then come to my class. And every year there's at least a few stories like that. And of course, for every story I know about, I probably have, you know, 10 students in my classes who I don't know about. Right.
Yeah.
I think trying to be, as a professor, you know, trying to be sensitive to that and not assume that because you're not showing up and you look sleepy, like you don't care about my class. But then also for the students like me, who really had things easy, I'm also trying to let them know, like, you know, you there are things that you can do to by way of self-care that will make this a better experience for you and richer. The biggest one is sleep, because college-age human beings are the only human beings who systematically experiment with sleep. It's a very strange time of life where they're like, maybe I don't need to sleep. I don't know. My roommate said, like, what if I do one all-nighter and then I sleep and I just keep alternating? He literally tried that, and he quickly discovered, you know. Yeah, and I'm like, a sleep researcher could have said, if you want to, first of all, don't sleep less. But if you want to sleep less, that's like the worst way you could do it, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, to wrap this up, the self-care, it's connected to everything else they do. And so it's worth paying some attention to.
There's an interesting study you talk about in that chapter by Pitchert and Anderson. It's from 1977 about the burglar or the home buyer, which I think is interesting in terms of perspective. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So in this study, the experimenters had everybody read a story, and it's about two boys who skip school. And they go to one of the boys' house, and it's not that exciting a story. They don't have misadventures or anything. The key thing in the story is that some people were told beforehand, you are to think about this as if you might be a burglar. And in other people are reading the same story, and they're told you are to think about this as if you're a potential home buyer in the neighborhood. So it's kind of predictable that when they later ask people about the story, people remember different details. So the person who was a burglar remembers that there was a ladder lying out in the yard. The person who was thinking about being a home buyer remembered details like there was a new roof on the home. What was more interesting was they then asked people to switch perspectives. So they said, I told you to think about this as if you were a burglar. Suppose you were a home buyer. Now think about the story and see if anything different comes to mind. And lo and behold, different things do come to mind. Details that people hadn't remembered. I mean, they were encouraged to try and be as complete as they could be in retelling the story. They suddenly were able to dredge up different details. So perspective really matters in memory. The kind of predictable effect is that it matters when memories are going into the memory vault. So if I'm thinking burglar, I'm looking for and paying attention to different details. But what's, I think, a little more surprising is once the thing's already in memory, the story's in memory, I can dredge up different details by taking a different perspective.
This is interesting. This is interesting to me in a couple of different ways. One is a future of work and the idea of like, what is the work that humans are going to do, which is things that AI isn't. And I have been this week obsessed with ChatGPT-4. I had it write a couple of press releases for us. Very good. Okay. Very good. But then I was actually thinking about this in the context of my wife, the who has the comedy program, because she basically people entering the industry now, which is different than when we were coming up, is you don't know if you could be a great stand-up and you're ending up in the writer's room. Or you could end up as an actor. You know, a lot of stand-ups end up as actors and improvisers end up. So she's creating people to kind of do everything and teaching them everything from improv. And one of the things she talks about differences in improv and sketch is that when you're improvising, you're doing a lot of perspective taking, suggestions from the audience, and then doing your material and is like, was that what you kind of look for? But a stand-up does a lot of perspective giving, especially in the beginning of their act, because they have to get the audience to understand how to enjoy their humor. So a lot of that, if you think about your favorite stand-ups, is self-deprecating. Patton Oswalt's a slob. Amy Schumer's a slut. I mean, you know, John Mulaney's a drunk. I mean, there's like, oh, like that's pretty much what they all do. And so, again, we talked about context before, but I'm curious in sort of hearing that is that it strikes me that to be able to do that shift is a really good skill to have in life, because the more that you can shift yourself to maybe see it the way the buyer would see it in this mm-hmm. case, as opposed to the seller, or if you're the seller, you know, that a lot of people are kind of stuck in their POV.
Yeah. No, that's a beautiful observation. I'd never put it together that way. But yeah, I very much agree. I mean, this on both sides that, yeah, there are times that you, in order to get people to understand where you're coming from, you have to give it some framing. This goes back to your observation before. Mm-hmm. Context is everything.
Yeah.
And so you need to know that I'm a slob or I'm a drunk or I'm a college professor or whatever it is, so that you can sort of understand how I'm seeing it, how I put these things together. And then it's of course quite intuitive that for me to have a productive interaction with you, I've got to understand where you're coming from and how you've put these things together. So yeah, I quite agree with that.
Well, and the way you're going to find it. Go ahead.
So let me ask you a question. So you introduced this with ChatGPT. So you're thinking that this might be something that ChatGPT is like, it's basically theory of mind. And there has been, I've seen a few headlines, which is basically how I've been keeping up with ChatGPT work, that theory of mind is a problem for ChatGPT.
Yeah. So I signed up to OpenAI and I decided to, I'll tell the story. We were on this call and I made a joke about Second City announcing that we're going to open a show called COVID the Musical, except it never opens because everyone's sick with COVID. Mm-hmm. And just whatever, this is what I do. And people laughed. And then we realized April Fool's is coming up. So we're like, hey, maybe we do this. So I asked ChatGPT before, I said, write a press release for Second City Presents COVID the Musical.
Nice.
Put it in press release form, came up with 3 song titles. I'm sure there's other, they stole that from someone, whatever, that's fine. Right. It actually put the director, my friend Anthony LeBlanc, who I have not told yet, but is a computer guy. So I'm like, he studied this stuff at Tulane. It's like they picked the one guy. Mm-hmm. And we were all laughing because I was like, you know, literally all we need to do is shush this up. If we change some things, it could be kind of funny. And we're not going to do it because we sort of like, might be insensitive because people actually get COVID here and have not been able to do shows. But in experimenting with this, what I'm amazed by the language, how good the language is, and the knowledge. I don't see it as so much as a replacement as, but here's what I see it as. This is rote writing. The press releases are mostly rote writing. So allowing some of that to be done by a computer that you then go fix up to me is not taking away an artful job. Mm-hmm. I think there's still the idea of the art, you know, on top of that is one thing, but also asking the right question, to go back to your questions thing, because I think the prompt is essential. If you don't know how to prompt ChatGPT to get you the thing you want, you're probably going to get less imaginative work. I don't know. I haven't thought about it that much more deeply than that.
Well, I will say I have thought, and I'm sure this idea isn't original to me, that ChatGPT would be an excellent member of an improv troupe. Exactly because Sometimes it will be spot on, and then other times it will just be a damn curveball, right? Yeah. And then everybody else will have to figure out how to pick up the pieces. I would go to that show. I think that would be funny.
Well,
the other thing I'll mention just very briefly, the one time I played with it, I asked ChatGPT to write a description of working memory theory in the style of Damon Runyon.
Okay.
It sounded like third rate Edward G. Robinson. It was a lot of you see.
So it had a very coarse understanding of that genre as opposed to sort of the literary aspect of that genre.
Exactly.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, and the fact is we all know it's going to evolve because it learns. So I think that's also going to be the interesting thing is see at what point does it pick up the Runyon-esque ability of language. I mean, if this thing can start spitting out, you know, fairly decent Fitzgerald, I think we're like,
that's going to be, that raises some questions for sure.
There's a place for that. All right. Couple more things before we get to our yes and story. And because your work in memory obviously is a big part of this book. I hadn't heard the term prospective memory. And this is in where we talk about how you're planning your work. So talk to us about what that is.
Yeah, prospective memory just means planning to remember something. So when you drive to work in the morning and you realize you're almost out of gas, but you don't want to stop now because you're running late, and you think to yourself, I got to remember to get gas on my way home, that you're engaging in prospective memory. And as like your intuition about the success of prospective memory is probably pretty accurate, which is sometimes you get it and sometimes you don't. And the sort of obvious thing to do is not rely on prospective memory and instead give yourself a cue in the environment that you can't miss.
Sticky notes all around me.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, in the old days, it was before sticky notes, it was tie a string around your finger. And then you'll say, why is this string around my finger? And then that prompts, oh, I put it there because thus and so. So that's what prospective memory is. And it's an important part of daily planning, certainly.
Well, you talk about this in the book as well, the importance of keeping a calendar.
And remarkably, I mean, this is a book for students. But I will say, I mean, like, I got really far in life without keeping a calendar.
Me too.
Because I didn't have that many responsibilities. And the breaking point, as I put it, I made do with systems of apologies, excuses, and writing things on my hand. That was my time management system. But eventually, when I was,
so I'd love to see that pitch for the book.
Yeah, I missed a lab meeting. My advisor and the other members of the lab were about 10 feet away from me. I was happily reading in my office. Yeah. They were all out there at a meeting. And I realized something had to give. So I do think, I mean, it of course depends on who you are, but I think for many people, a calendar can be a pretty simple affair. And it's just a matter of making a habit of always carrying it with you, which is now trivial because everybody has a phone with them. And then actually remembering to write things down and check the calendar periodically. And of course, you can get more elaborate. And some people like to have lots of different to-do lists, and you've got a birthday list, and you've got, you know, a restaurant list and all these other things. I think, you know, there are people who really enjoy that kind of thing. My father was one of them. And they're, you know, they're going to do it, whatever I say.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
And they don't need any help doing it because they revel in it. But for most of us, I think you can keep it pretty simple and it'll work.
You also write in here, quote, first, follow your passion is slightly off. Follow your purpose would be better. And we've had people on, professors from Harvard, who've talked about the importance of purpose. And again, this is school, this is work, this is life, I think. But talk about how you're talking about it in this context.
Yeah, I mean, purpose is the research on what makes people feel happy and fulfilled in what they do. Is it doesn't follow passion so much as it follows purpose. People who feel like they are part of something bigger feel like they're contributing to a team. And some of the original studies on this, you know, people were really puzzled because they found there were jobs that most people would say objectively seem, they just don't seem like very appealing jobs at all. So one of the really striking examples was the person who goes into the emergency operating room after the patient's gone, the physicians, the nurse, everybody's gone, and there's blood on the floor and there's, you know, other, you know, human byproduct on the floor. And it's you're the one who's cleaning up and making it sanitary. And it's difficult, exacting, demanding work, physically demanding, cognitively demanding, and it doesn't pay very well. And there are a number of these people who were interviewed for this research who loved their job. And when they were asked why, they felt like part of a team. They knew that what they were doing was absolutely essential. And I mean, candidly, you know, like this, of course, is, I don't think these people are saints. I think this was a matter of a good fit between, you know, what they understood, what they felt strongly about, and this job. It's hard not to sort of say like, gosh, I do feel like they're saints. Like to have that attitude seems so wonderful. But that's not, I think, the right way to think about it. Again, sort of what we're talking about is happiness and purpose. And that's what that study was demonstrating so beautifully.
That made me think when Barbara Ehrenreich passed away, I remember reading Nickel and Dimed as a young person, loving it. And then some of the critiques I wasn't aware of, which were because she talks about the hard life and the bad life kind of people who are like cleaning hotel rooms, when in fact, there's actually pretty good research about people who clean hotel rooms who really enjoy what they do. And the physical, they're fit because they do, you know, that sort of physical labor, and being like, oh, wow, I just like, understand there that maybe we could have just been seeing it in a completely different way. Like if you know, it's the famous Kennedy story of walking through right NASA and he sees someone, a maintenance person said, what do you do? And I help put people on the moon.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I started here as a dishwasher and I had a lot of pride of being part of the team. I felt I was part of the team making people laugh, even though I wasn't on stage.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is a wonderful recipe for feeling good about your work and feeling purposeful and so on. But as you say, and I've just to reiterate it, there is inevitably a fit between yourself and that job and what you feel good about.
Yeah, all right. A couple more things, and this is in the how to stay focused section. Multitasking, not a thing, right?
Not a thing. Yeah, you're switching. And switching always carries a cost. There was terrific work on this, mostly done in the 1990s. And what they did was they had people try and keep in mind two tasks, and then they would get a signal from a computer about which task they were to do. And the key here is that they would make the task as simple as possible. So it would be something like if a light illuminates, you're looking at a light bulb. If it illuminates, you press a button here right in front of you. If you hear a tone, you've got headphones on. If you hear a tone, you depress a foot pedal. And in each case, you do that as quickly as you can. So you're trying to make this as simple as possible. And you still get switching costs between, like, if the light goes off twice, you're fast, you know, two times in a row, you're faster that second time compared to if you hear the tone and then the light, where you're switching from doing one thing to another thing. So yeah, multitasking is definitely not a thing.
Video in the background, music in the background.
Yeah, so you get slightly different effects here. So video in the background, people pretty consistently think, it's just background noise. I'm really not paying attention to it. And the studies on this, they're very careful to try and get people to engage with video the way they actually would when they're working. So they'll give them something to read, and then later there's going to be a reading comprehension test. But they say, like, stream whatever you want, whatever you would normally stream while you were reading, have the volume high, low, whatever you do, how just do it the way you would normally do it. And what they find is, there's always a cost to video going in the background. Music there is a much more complex story. So with music, you can see anything. You can see cost, you can see it, neutral, or you can see benefit. It took them a while to unravel what's going on here. the characteristic of the music is much less important than you would think. Everybody immediately thinks, oh, lyrics versus no lyrics or something right. like that. The only content effect is if it's music you hate, there's guaranteed to be a cost. But if there's not, music actually has two opposing effects. It does distract you, just as video does, but music is also sort of energizing, uplifting, arousing is the way psychologists describe it. So your autonomic nervous system gets going. This is, of course, why we listen to music when we're working out. So whether there's going to be a cost or a benefit depends on how motivated you were to do the primary work. So like whether you needed that boost, what your state was, whether you were a little tired or not. And also the difficulty of the work and probably a few other factors. So that's why it's really kind of a complicated story. And you just need to, if you like listening to music while you're working, you just need to monitor closely whether or not it's helping or hurting. And be aware of the fact that people do typically underestimate cost. So multitasking, for example, when you look at lab studies where they interview people about like, how do you think this is going? People do recognize that multitasking costs them, but they consistently underestimate how much.
Right. And you talk about social media and you say this, and I thought this was provocative, that wanting and enjoying are not the same thing. Yeah. And when we have to think about when we're engaging with social media, are we enjoying, are we wanting? And I think what you're saying is we're wanting in the same way my wife joked the other morning, I woke up and I'm like, what is it about that first sip of coffee? And she said, you mean your addiction to coffee?
Yeah. Yeah. That's coffee. Fair. Is medicine. Coffee is medicine. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. So no, the difference between wanting and enjoying, and I want to be very clear with your listeners there. This is not empirically based. This is speculation and based on
going on Twitter right now with Jonathan Haidt. And I don't know if you've seen any of this on academic Twitter.
No. What is
so Jonathan Haidt has written about the sort of evils of social media and a number of people are coming back at him with certain kinds of studies or things, his studies, and he has been highlighting them. And putting them on a Substack saying, I want critiques of my work. I want my work to improve. Please keep sending. And I'm like, this is the most generous response to a critique. And if we all did this, we'd hopefully stop yelling at each other.
Yes. Yeah. No, John's very good about that. And John, who I've known forever, John stayed when John first was interviewing at UVA as a potential faculty member. He stayed at my house. That's how John. Yeah, so we've been close friends forever, and he is amazing that way. He's very quick to go out on a limb, yep. but then he's very quick to say, "Cut me down!" You got good saws, cut me down. Mm-hmm. So what in the world were we talking about, Kelly? Oh, we were talking about wanting
and enjoying
versus enjoying. Yeah. So. People, of course, bring up dopamine and how you're like after the dopamine hit when you're on social media. And what I want to point out is that dopamine is not just implicated in reward as pleasure. It's implicated in reward as do that again, as part of the system. It's a neurotransmitter that participates in a system that prompts you to do things repeatedly, encourages, regulates behavior in that way, not just feeling good. There are other neurotransmitters that are probably more important for that. So the theory is that these two things really can be separate. And I think that it certainly matches the experience of some of my students when I talk with them about it in these terms, that initially, take Instagram as an example. Instagram was really rewarding. It was really fun. It was exciting. Mm-hmm. Now it feels like I feel this compulsion to do it, but when I get on Instagram, I'm not having that much fun.
Right.
And some of my students actually say, like, actually, it's a burden. You know, like my friends expect me to come on and say, like, oh my God, you're so pretty. And like, you know, in my head, I'm like, you're not even that pretty in that picture. Like, but I have to like it and I have to comment about how fabulous that picture is. And the whole thing just feels artificial and silly. And so this is really about distraction, being distracted by social media. I think your perspective context again, your perspective on social media might be different if you think to yourself, if you recognize, yeah, actually this isn't as much fun. And when I'm trying to get some work done, I'm feeling that compulsion to go on social media. It's not because it's going to be that great when I get there. This is sort of, and the rewarding part has diminished. But the compulsion part of dopamine is still active. That has not diminished. So I just invite my readers to think about that as a possibility and feels like a fit for you. It doesn't, you know, tell you exactly what you ought to do about it, but I think it probably will encourage you to think about your compulsion differently.
I think people are considering this a lot, and I don't think it's just because of like the Netflix documentary, and I'll use Twitter as an example too, because like I've cultivated a following on Twitter. I enjoy it. That is kind of my kind of compulsion. And I think I'm probably going to leave because the changes that they're being, that Musk is making are not appealing to me. And it's already more clunky and there's other problems. And I had to sort of say to myself, like, well, what would it mean to leave? And I'm like, it's not a big, this is not going to be a big deal. Yeah. And it may be on a professional level. I felt like I had some, but it's not, again, like it, I don't know, when the sort of rubber hit the road on there, I was like, wow, okay. And then what is Facebook? And I know a lot of my friends who've left Facebook, and no one is like, I really want to be back on. Almost everyone I know who's left a social media thing has been like, it's fine.
It's interesting because I was just the other day, I was at a school and I was talking with a bunch of high school teachers, high school English teachers, about encouraging students to read. And one of the things we were talking about is the sort of seconds of pleasure nature of social media. And I was that you don't really miss and is not really memorable. And I was encouraging them to, encourage their students to think about this. In particular, one teacher who I had sat in on a lesson plan that he had done of a short story that was just brilliant. And I said, like, your students are going to remember that lesson on George Saunders months later. And he said, I absolutely know they will. I said, point that out to them and also ask them, tell me the last TikTok you saw. And like, how long are you going to be thinking of it? Tell me any TikTok you saw 3 months ago, right? It doesn't mean TikTok's not fun or can't be fun, but it is a very different type of pleasure. And probably one that is, given that it doesn't stick with you in the same way, I think arguably less important.
I feel very heartened that George Saunders is being taught in high school. There's anything that's come out of this conversation, I think that's great. All right. We always end the podcast with a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
I do. So this was a dramatic moment in my career.
Love it.
When I started my career, so I'm here because I wrote a book about learning, and I've spent most of the last 20 years writing about the application of cognitive psychology to everyday life, especially education. I didn't start my professional life that way. I started as a basic researcher of memory. And my work was sort of at the intersection of cognition and neuroscience. I was working on quite technical issues about how to think about different systems of memory and whether or not that it made sense to think about memory that way and so on. And so I actually tell this story in the book, and I mentioned the old joke that when you get your PhD, your parents say, like, my son's a doctor, but not the type of doctor who helps people. And I actually went one better. I was a memory researcher who couldn't really tell you how to make your memory any better.
Yeah.
So that's where I was. And I get a call. So this is like, I'm at UVA like 10 years at this point. I'm 10 years post PhD. And I get a call from someone who I sort of know, who runs an education nonprofit, and says, we're having our annual conference for teachers in Nashville. We're going to be about 600 teachers there. Why don't you come and talk to them about cognitive psychology? And I said, I don't know anything about cognitive psychology. And they said, well, yeah, we get that, but we just think teachers would find it interesting. So Kelly, I've got an ego like anybody else. And I was like, sure, I'll come talk to your teachers about cognitive psychology. So like 6 months later, I realized this talk is in 2 weeks. I'm going to have to say something to all these people. And I absolutely panic because it occurs to me, like, what do I know about learning that teachers, experienced teachers, don't already know? What am I going to tell them? I couldn't think of anything really good. So I'd been teaching introduction to cognitive psychology to sophomores for, 10 years now. So I just picked out some slides of some phenomena that I thought were kind of interesting and sort of put together an hour-long talk. Meanwhile, I had been dating this woman who is a teacher. And so I had said to her before I had had this realization, I'm like, hey, I'm giving this talk in Nashville to a bunch of teachers. Like, why don't you come with me and you can, you know, see what I do or whatever. So she said, that sounds great. So she's now with me. Half an hour before I have to give the talk, I said to her, you can't come. Like I literally begged her not to come because I was so sure it was going to be a disaster. Okay. So the outcome is, it was a great success. Teachers didn't know this content, did think that it was really interesting and important for their classrooms. And the yes and part was that in the audience was the editor of a magazine called American Educator, which goes out to about 1 million teachers every quarter. It's published by one of the two large teachers unions. And the editor approached me afterwards and said, would you like to do some writing for us? And my first thought was, this was a one-off, you know, like I don't do education. I don't really know anything about education. And the yes and was, I did say yes. And I sort of went more and more all in. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, this is obviously important. And even though it's a little bit of a scary new direction for me, this is not really what I was hired to do at the university. Is translate what psychologists know for others. What it was really hard to do is create new knowledge. But I decided I was going to really run with this. And I not only started writing for American Educator, I started looking for other opportunities to communicate with educators and others about what psychologists know, because it was so obvious to me that my field had been doing a terrible job of this. And I thought it was interesting and important. So that's my yes and story for you.
Did the girlfriend come and see you speak?
She later she did. So this is my wife.
There we go. Come on. Yeah. Even more.
Yeah. So she has heard me speak. And as I said, she's a teacher. And so we've now just recently started to have opportunities where we're doing things together. And that's been great fun.
The book is called Outsmart Your Brain: Why Learning is Hard, How You Can Make It, and How You Can Make It Easy. Dan Willingham, thank you for coming on the pod.
It was a great fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumblebear, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.